The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Radvaz and the Rebirth of Egyptian Jewry, is dedicated to the memory and honor of Yaakov ben Eliyahu Nerior, Unomi Bas Yitzchok Tichia, Mr. and Mrs. Jack and Nellie Tawil. The very name Egypt conjures up a plethora of images as diverse as this ancient history is long. One of the images which Egypt evokes is that of a sanctuary. When there's a famine in the land of Canaan, shortly after the patriarch Abraham of Rome Avinu's arrival, Egypt provided him with a safe haven. 215 years later, when famine again struck Canaan, Egypt again provided sanctuary for Avram's grandson Yaakov, Jacob, together with his whole family. This event is remembered for all time in the commandment of the Torah, Lo sasad mitzri ki ger ho yisu ba'arzo. You shall not abhor an Egyptian because you were a stranger in his land. In other words, don't forget that they took care of you in your time of need and offered you sanctuary. Some 1,100 years later, Egypt again provided refuge for the Jews. Shortly after the destruction of Jerusalem and the first temple, the Babylonians appointed one of the most prominent of the survivors, Gedaliah ben Achikam, to be governor of Judea. Soon afterwards, he was brutally murdered by an usurper, Yishmael ben Nesanya. We commemorate that tragedy every year by the fast day, Tzom Gedaliah, Gedaliah's fast. The remnant of the Jewish community, afraid of reprisals by the Babylonians, and under the leadership of Yochanan ben Kareach, decided to flee to safety, to Egypt. The historic haven of the past once again provided refuge. Throughout the Second Temple period, Jews resettled in Egypt and the Jewish community flourished there. Before its destruction in the reign of Trajan in the year 116, it had a population of well over 1 million Jews. Despite setbacks over the years, Egypt continued to provide Jews with a safe haven where they could settle and ultimately flourish. By the time of the conquest of Egypt by the Arabs in the year 640, Egypt again had a very large and prosperous Jewish community. The following is a letter written by Amir ibn Alas, the Arab general who conquered Alexandria, to his superior, the Caliph Umar. Quote, I have captured a city, is Alexandria, from the description of which I shall refrain. Suffice it to say that I have seized therein 4,000 villas with 4,000 baths, 40,000 poll tax-paying Jews, and 400 places of entertainment for the royalty. Throughout the Gaonic period, Egypt was a major center of Torah and produced many great scholars. Rav Yitzchok Yisraeli, the great scholar and physician, was born in Egypt about the year 832. 50 years later, in the year 888, Rav Sadia Gaon was born in Fayum, south of Alexandria. By the time he left, in the year 915, he was an accomplished Torah and Hebraic scholar. Evidently, it would seem there were other people of great stature who lived there, from whom Rav Sadia took instruction. Egypt received a new infusion of scholarship with the arrival of Rav Shmaria ben Rav Elchanan, approximately the year 960. Even though Rav Shmaria studied in Babel, in Babylon, there is evidence that he originally came from Egypt, where his father, Rav Elchanan, was also a Rosh Yeshiva. Even after Egypt was conquered in the year 969 by an independent Shiite dynasty from North Africa, the Fatimids, it still remained a vibrant center of Torah, and remained so well into the 16th century and beyond.
During the period of the expulsion from Spain, starting from the year 1492, Egypt again resumed its traditional role and provided an accommodating haven for those desperate Jews seeking asylum. To get a better appreciation of the state of the Jewish community in Egypt when the first refugees arrived, I would like to read together with you several accounts of life in Egypt at the end of the 15th century. The first is from Rav Avadya Bartanura, a disciple of the Maharik, Rav Yosef Kalon, and one of the outstanding Torah scholars of that period. He is well known throughout the Jewish world for his classic commentary to the Mishnah. Leaving his native Italy in the year 1485, he traveled for 3 years till he settled in the city of Jerusalem in the year 1488. His letter to his father describing his travels is an important source for historians. This is how he described the city of Cairo. This is on the first page. I shall not speak of the grandeur of Cairo and of the multitude of men to be seen streaming there, for many before me have described them, and all that has been said of the town is true. It is not completely surrounded by a wall, though there are several places here and there protected in that way. The town is very animated, and one hears the different languages of the foreigners who inhabit it. It is situated between the Red Sea and the Mediterranean, and all merchants come from India, Ethiopia, and the countries of Prester John. Prester John is a legendary king of Ethiopia and its environs. Through the Red Sea to Cairo, both to sell their wares, which consist of spices, pearls, and precious stones, and to purchase commodities which come from France, Germany, Italy, and Turkey across the Mediterranean Sea through Alexandria to Cairo. And as Alexandria was the major port, so really from all the whole world, goods came to Alexandria, and from them it was transported to Cairo. And he continues on, in Cairo there are now about 700 Jewish families. Of these, 50 are Samaritans, called also Kuthians, Kusim. 150 are Karaites, those Karoyim, who believe only in the written Torah and deny the validity of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition. And the rest, Rabbinates, those the bulk or the mainstream traditional Jews. The Samaritans are the richest of all the Jews in Cairo and fill most of the higher offices of state, and are cashiers and administrators. One of them is said to have the property of 200,000 pieces of gold. The Karaites are richer than the Rabbinates, but they're opulent men even among the latter. And it continues on, the Karaites, the Karoyim, mix amongst the Rabbinates and try to become friendly with them. Among the Jews in Cairo, there are money changers and merchants, for the country is large, and some branch of industry is open to everyone. For trade, there's no better place in the world than Cairo. It is easy to grow rich. Hence, one meets there with innumerable foreigners of all nations and languages. You may go out by night as well as by day, for all the streets are lighted with torches, and people sleep on the ground before the shop. The Jew can buy everything that is necessary, such as meat, cheese, fish and vegetables, and in general, all that he requires for everything is sold in the Jew's street. It's like one stop. The Jews cook at home only for Shabbos, since men as well as women are occupied during the whole week and can therefore buy everything in the market. Things just don't change. By the 1480s, after the advent of the Spanish Inquisition, Marranos, those were committed Jews who outwardly held all the trappings of good Catholics, escaped Spain, often penniless, and settled in countries where they could openly practice Judaism. This is how Rav Avadya describes the Marrano community in Cairo. In Cairo, again, this is part of this letter, there are 50 families of forced apostates, Marranos, from Spain, who have all done penance. They are mostly poor, having left their possessions, their parents and ancestors, and come here to seek shelter under the wings of the Lord God of Israel. As I said before, in the year 1492, Egypt fulfilled its historic role as a safe haven for Jews, and it began receiving the first of what was to become a whole-scale migration to Egypt. One of the outstanding Sephardic or Spanish Torah scholars who eventually settled in Egypt was Rav Moshe Alashgar. Born around the year 1465 in the city of Zamora, Spain, Rav Moshe studied under one of Spain's greatest scholars, Rav Shmuel Valinci, in Toledo, together with Rav Yaakov Ibn Chaviv, whose life we touched upon in the last lecture. As Rav Yaakov Ibn Chaviv, recall, in 1492, went first to Portugal, and after the forced conversion, left Portugal and settled in Salonika, where he became the leading Torah sage in Salonika. He's the author of the Ein Yaakov, you know, that collection of the Agadata section of the Talmud, the Midrashic section of the Talmud, plus his own commentary. Now, getting back to Rav Moshe Alashgar, in 1492, he fled Spain, and after a harrowing journey, finally settled in Tunis, in North Africa. When Tunis was overrun by Spain in 1510, Rav Moshe fled to Patras in Greece, where he opened a yeshiva. In the year 1522, he moved to Cairo, where he was appointed a dayan, a rabbinic judge, in the Beis Din of the Radvaz. It was the rabbinic court of Radvaz, where we're going to speak of soon. Towards the end of his life, he moved to Safed, Sfas, and finally to Jerusalem, where he died in the year 1542. This is how he describes the Jewish community of Cairo in his time, as in page 2. Praise be God, we have so many members in our community in Egypt that we don't even know the exact number, as it had grown evidently tremendously since Rav Avadya Bar Tanura. And we have so many erudite scholars as well as gifted Talmudic analysts who have the ability to uplift mountains of evidence, grind them into their composite parts, and extract superior sifted flour. They speak in a soft voice, not in loud or harsh tones. Now, there's his impression not only on the level of their scholarship, their erudition, but in terms of their genteelness, their refinement. One of the reasons of the vibrancy of the Egyptian community was the unique institution of the position of Nogid, or Jewish ruler. Originally appointed by the Fatimid Sultan, approximately in the year 978, or there is about, this institution survived the various changes in government, first under Saladin, and later under the Mamluks. Finally, when the Ottoman Turks conquered Egypt in the year 1517, the office of Nogid was at least temporarily abrogated. It seems, though, that it was eventually restored under official Ottoman sanction. It seems to have lasted in some form after that restoration for almost 200 years. On page 2, in section 2, we start with a description of that thing. We start with first of Yosef Sambari, a historian who lived in 17th century Egypt, who describes the creation of that position. Really much of this he owes to a response, a matshuva of the Radvaz, Rav David ben Zimra, the chief rabbi of Egypt for 40 years during the 16th century, who relates other important details regarding this office. So I think we should turn to page 3. And this is from a matshuva of the Radvaz. You need to know that the situation of the Nossi's leadership was originally... this position, which was called Nogid, which is a ruler, was initially filled by a descendant of the house of King David. That's why he's called Nossi, the prince. This situation essentially continued on. Close to the beginning of the independent Arabic rule in Egypt, the king, who is called by them Khal Khalifa, married the daughter of the king of Baghdad. When she came to Egypt, she questioned him regarding the Jews, if they had a king or Nossi. The king, this is the Egyptian king, told her the Jews did not have a king or nasi. She replied, "In the kingdom of my father, there are many Jews, and they have a nasi, who is called Resh Galusa, this is exilarch, who is a descendant of King David. And my father is blessed through him. He gives him great honors, for he is the Sion of kings and prophets." He immediately asked the king of Baghdad to provide him with a descendant of King David, blessed memory. The king sent him a wise and understanding person who was a direct descendant of the Nasiim, the princes. He appointed him as Nogid, leader over all of the Jews in his kingdom. From then on, the position of Nogid began in Egypt. He had power through the edict of the king to punish and enforce the law through the use of the cane and whip. After the descendants of David of this branch had either died out or were not fit for the position, the candidacy for the position became based on wisdom and achievement. And there was no longer was it because of genealogy, because of the tracing descent from David, but rather these were the greatest members of the community were appointed to the position of Nogid. The Nogid would judge alone in monetary cases as a single judge, and would punish, flog, and excommunicate according to the needs of the hour. All of this was done through the decree of the king. The situation continued until the Turks came to power. Even though the position of Nogid came to an end due to our sins, and we have no governmental authority granting him power, as this was written by the Radvaz in the period subsequent to this, in the period of Ottoman rule, the previous custom remains in place that a single judge can adjudicate in the stead of the Nogid. In other words, in the period when there no longer was a Nogid, in other words, this leader, the Jewish community accepted upon themselves an equivalent person that they felt he would judge and be the sole judge. The community appoints someone who is fit for this position, appoints him to be their judge. Since they select him, as if they all accepted him upon themselves, and this decision is legally binding. Even those who were not present at his selection, that was because it was a selection of the whole community, one is elected to this position, are bound by his decision, since the leadership of the community chose him in the presence of the members of the community. He has the ability to judge on his own. Since he sits in that position, they come before him accepting his authority. It has the equivalent force of a formal acceptance, and his rule is law. During the time when Rav Avadya Bar Tanura traveled to Egypt, and this is in 1488, the Nogid was Rav Nosson Sholeil. This is what he wrote about him. Again, it gives you a sense of the position. This is on the bottom of page 3. The Jewish Nogid, who has his residence in Cairo, is appointed over all the Jews who are under the dominion of the king of Egypt. He has all the power of a king and can punish and imprison those who are in opposition to his decrees. He appoints the dayanim, the rabbinic judges in every community. The present prince lived formally for a long time in Jerusalem, was obliged to leave it on account of the elders, the calumniators and informers who were there. He is called Rav Nosson HaKohen. He is rich, wise, pious, old, and is a native of Barbary. In other words, this is North Africa, like from central to west North Africa. When I came to Cairo, he showed me much honor, loved me as a father loves his son, and tried to dissuade me altogether from going to Jerusalem on account of the informers there. All scholars and rabbis formerly in Jerusalem left the city in haste in order to preserve their lives from the oppressions of the elders. The Jews who were in Jerusalem, about 300 families, disappeared by degrees on account of the great taxes and burdens laid upon them by the elders, so that the poor only remained and women. And there was scarcely one to whom the name of man could justly be given. In the next lecture, Mir Yosef Shem, I'll go in greater length about how Jerusalem developed from the time of Avadya Bar Tanura to the mid-16th century. And in a subsequent letter, he writes, after Avadya had already settled in Jerusalem, "I lived here in Jerusalem in the house of the Nogid." Now, as the Nogid had lived in Yerusha, he abandoned it, but he still had his house. And he lived there, who appointed me ruler of his household. It's important to note just that at that time, all of Eretz Yisrael was under the jurisdiction of the Egyptian Sultan. It was the Sultan of the Mamluk dynasty actually had hegemony, you know, over Eretz Yisrael, Syria, and that was all part of Egyptian rule. Later on, says when the Ottomans conquered it, then they took over everything. So therefore, the Nugget was therefore titular head of Israel as well. That's why he had a difficult time dealing with the people there, which just goes to show you, even though you're an elected official, it's like the old story. I believe the story goes that Ben Gurion was speaking to Sir Winston Churchill, and Ben Gurion told him that you may be the prime minister of 50 million people, but I'm the prime minister of 2 million prime ministers. In the year 1502, Rav Nosson Sholeil passed away. His nephew, Rav Yitzchak Sholeil, was appointed in his place. And it's interesting here on page 4, paragraph C, we quote of a letter from Avram Rav Eliezer HaLevi, one of the exiles from Spain, which is quoted in the Sefer Keter Torah of Marash de Avila. It's interesting, the Sefer Keter Torah, the thrust of this Sefer, this work, is to prove that, as we're going to see in other lectures, we're going to see in the subsequent lecture, that Torah scholars are free from communal taxes, and showed not only the basis for this, but historically how there were, through time, in community after community, in different instances, that there were measures taken to ensure that Torah scholars were free from taxes. Basically, it's the equivalent we have in our own communities, that the churches and synagogues are free from taxes, simply because they feel it's in the best interest of the community at large to have such institutions. If you have them in your midst, there's a greater surety of the quality of the community. And he writes here, this is Avraham Sibber of Eliezer HaLevi, in those days there lived in Egypt a scholar who was a leader, Nogid, commander and minister, who was appointed by the king over all the Jews in Egypt, Israel, and all of the areas under their rule. This person's name was Nosson HaKohen Sholeil, a scholar of far-reaching knowledge and descendant of a prestigious family. When Rav Nosson the Nugget passed away from this world to experience the eternal light of the next world, the Jews, after careful counsel, chose the Honorable Yitzchak Sholeil as Nugget. Rav Yitzchak Sholeil, on page 5, is referred to in a responsum by the Mari Beirav, of Yaakov Beirav, who is going to be the subject of the next lecture. At one time was one of the leading scholars in Egypt, and subsequently emigrated to Israel. But he describes it at the time of the Nazarite, or the Nozer. Nozer is one who had to take a vow not to cut his hair, not to drink wine, not to go to a graveyard. Rav Yitzchak Sholeil, a blessed memory, while he was in Egypt, we discussed this issue regarding Rav Nosson Sholeil. And there's a question, this Rav Nosson Sholeil is referring to the previous Nugget or another person by that name, who did not make his will be known about being buried in Eretz Yisrael. We decided that Rav Nosson's body be brought to Eretz Yisrael, and this is what was done. But he's called the Nazarite. He's a Nazar, which is very unusual. How does one become a Nazar? How does one become a Nazarite? So we have, it's interesting, there's a tshuva response from Eliyahu Mizrahi, who was the chief rabbi of in Turkey at the time. Now, Egypt was not part of this. Egypt was not was not part of the Ottoman Empire yet. But he was in discussing the issues here. This is Revelio Mizrahi writes, there was an incident wherein Reuven made a vow to become a Nazir Shimshon if Shimon would become a Dayan. Just generally in rabbinic literature, as in Talmudic literature, when we want to speak about a person X versus Y, we call X Reuven and we call Y Shimon. And this is, so in any situation, you always have that same Reuven and Shimon are doing this and that and the other thing. You know, it's like John Doe, if we refer. A Nazir Shimshon is a vow of being a Nazirite where there is no annulment allowed. It's just like Samson. In other words, he would never be allowed to cut his hair, ever. Reuven was the Nugget, as we're referring to as Rav Yitzchak Shelel, but he did not want to mention him by name, at the time, and he had the power to prevent Shimon from becoming a Dayan. Subsequently, the Nugget wanted to appoint someone else as Dayan instead of Shimon, but he couldn't find a suitable candidate and regretted his vow. Because he needed a Dayan, a rabbinic judge. There was nobody else of the stature of this Shimon, and he's stuck. And he evidently, in his, you know, in his anger, you know, that I'm not going to appoint this person, you know, it's basically, it's equivalent to what we would say over my dead body. So he says, you know, I'm making a vow to be a Nazir Shimshon, in other words, to make this irrevocable vow, you know, if I appoint him. And he was forced to appoint him. All the sages of Egypt gathered together in order to find grounds to annul the vow. In other words, to annul the vow, not on the basis of normal annulment, but some sort of other grounds. After much discussion, some of them decided that the vow had no validity. And he quotes, after Yaakov Beirav was one of those who was in the minority, who said it has no validity. Evidently, Rav Yitzchak Shelel sided with the majority and remained a Nazir. And the Maribe Rav, referring to him after he had already, you know, dissented, in other words, he had said it doesn't have to be, but he referred to him as the Nazir, which is just a fascinating story. Because you should never hear of people becoming a Nazir. Rav Yitzchak was an unusual person and very well respected. And just to give you again a sense, again from this letter of Ram, this is Rav Eliezer Alevi, Rav Yitzchak Shelel ordered his servants to distribute out of his own pocket adequate funds to support the students in order they continue the study of Hashem's Torah. From the day he was appointed to the position of Nugget, he did not personally benefit from public support. The monies designated for a salary were donated to the students of Torah and to the judges. After the conquest of Egypt by the Ottoman Turks, Rav Yitzchak's term of office came to a close. He emigrated to Jerusalem, where he spent his remaining years. He died in the year 1524. One of the most important personages of that era was the Radvaz, Rav David ben Zimra. Under his leadership, it seems that Egypt reached new heights of Torah life, as described previously by Rav Moshe Alashker. Let us read together from the sources about his life. The first is from a disciple of his, Rav Yitzchak's Akrish, to the preface to his commentary on Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs. At their head, referring to the rabbinic leadership in Egypt, was the great eagle, our master and rabbi, the Radvaz. In other words, Rav David ben Zimra, who spread Torah and judged the people of Israel for 40 years in the territories of Egypt and Jerusalem and Safed for 20 years. And this is 40 in Egypt and Jerusalem and Sfas, and this is in Israel, in those two cities, for 20 years. His face was like that of a lion. There was no perversion of justice or special favoritism in his presence. He continues on, before him princes and noblemen bent their knees, and sages and men of discernment prostrated themselves. When I would see him from a distance, my heart would freeze. Then at one time the Holy Spirit rested upon him, and he left Egypt. He went to Jerusalem to behold the beauty of God, to stand and serve him. For he was as holy as an angel of God. We know, we quote here in number two, that according to the author of the Kore Hadoros, this was a work which was written in the late 17th century, Radvaz lived a long life filled with honor, wealth, and power. He lived to be over 110 years. This is at least according to the Kore Hadoros. And we'll continue on from the Sefer Divrei Yosef, Rav Yosef ben Yisro Sambari, again from the 17th century. Harab David Ibn Avi Zimra, called the Radvaz, was from those who left Spain. He traveled to Fez, and from Fez he came here to Egypt and settled here. And from the Shem HaGedolim, from Chaim Yosef David, this is Azuloy, Chidah, he writes, I heard that the Rav's family name was originally Ibn Zamira. As he changed from Zamira to Zimra, a song. And to this day, he still has family living in Morocco. Evidently, his family emigrated from Spain to Morocco and Fez. And not all of the family subsequently emigrated to Egypt. And there are people there. There's one source that says that actually he came from Zamora, which was the same place as Ramosha Lashkar. In Spain. There are certain reservations when quoting sources that are written over 100 years from the events discussed, you know, such as like the Sefer Kore Hadoros. I mean, it was written by a Talmud Chacham and David Conforti, but still, it's a question about the reliability of his sources. The Radvaz, we know, died in the year 1574. If he was over 110 when he died, then he must have been born before the year 1464. The dating, though, does not work out well if we consider the following facts. Here we quote here on page 8. This is from a tshuva of the Radvaz. I saw one of the latter authorities whose name was Harav Askandri. Askandrani, a blessed memory, who wrote the following. And then he continues on, I made acquaintance with this scholar while I was in Safed when I was 13 years old. Without a doubt, he was extremely pious and God-fearing, and expert in Talmud and Midrashim. There were in his generation over greater scholars than he. I therefore found it within myself to resolve his doubts and to make a ruling, because he took issue with a certain ruling that he made. And he felt, even though he was older than he, but he felt that it was within his power to disagree with him. But one thing historically we know, the Radvaz was in Sfas, in Safed, when the Radvaz was 13 years old. The Radvaz. He's describing himself. When I was 13 years old, I saw this rabbi. He was a great... was an elderly, he was one of the sages in Sfas. But the Radvaz was 13 years old living in Sfas. And he just, by the way, if we assume that he was, born in 1564 or before, then he must have been 13 in the year 1477 or so. But Safed, was at that time, was a real backwater. And Jews were not leaving Spain during that period. And just to keep that in mind, again, just the difficulty assuming, that he lived to be 110. In paragraph C, we touch upon the life of Rav Yosef Saragossi, who was a teacher. He was considered the teacher of the Radvaz. So I read in a letter which was written by Rav Chaim Saragossi, a grandson of Rav Yosef Saragossi, that his grandfather was from the group of Jews who were expelled from Sicily. They were expelled from Sicily between 1492 and 1493. He sanctified God's name and came to the land of Egypt. He was the teacher of the Radvaz. Subsequently, he went up to the holy city of Safed. Many miracles occurred to him. In the letter was written by his grandson, Chaim Saragossi, he praised his grandfather at length. But one thing we see... the Radvaz could not have come in contact with Rav Yosef Saragossi before the year of 1493. If he was born in the year, says, of 1464 or before that, he's always 29 or 30. It already creates a difficulty to consider a man. Like, by the time he's 30, he's whatever he is. In other words, he's probably well educated. To consider him to be his Rebbe, you know, his teacher, it creates a difficulty. In addition, here there's a letter which is quoted. Really, there was a Jewish German scholar by the name of Niebuhr, who was in the who was in London. He cataloged all the, you know, the manuscripts there. You know, he lived in the end of the 1800s, this Niebuhr, and he found a letter written by Avadia Bartanura, which he dates, at least from my sources, he dates in the year 1496. After there's all, when they date something, you also have to, and if you don't have the whole, you have to take every date with a grain of salt. But again, let's assume this is true. At that time, again, according to my sources, 1496, there arrived in Safed a prestigious person from Sicily whose name was Mar Yosef of Saragossa. He was a person of very great renown, as he was traveling to Safed by way of Sidon. The community of Sidon, together with the mayor of the city, came out to greet him and beseeched him to settle there. The heads of the community committed themselves to provide him with a salary of 50 gold coins a year. In addition, the mayor said that he would give him out of his own pocket another 20 adumim, these gold coins. Rav Yosef, however, was not comfortable living in that community and continued on to Safed, wherein he settled. So Rav Yosef came to Safed in the year, let's assume, this is 1496. You have to realize also that Radvaz was 13 years old when he came to Safed. Putting things together, it would seem most likely that the Radvaz was in Egypt as a young boy when Yosef Saragossa came. He became his disciple, and when Yosef Saragossa left Egypt, he went with his Rebbe. So he left together with his Rebbe and traveled with him to Tzfas. So there, this is where he met Rav Yosef Alexandri. That would be, if we assume the year, this is 1496, and if he was 13 at the time, that would mean that he was born in the year 1483, and he was 91 when he passed away in the year 1574. The Radvaz made a profound impact upon the life of the Jewish community in Egypt. Here's a sampling. Here's on the bottom, page 9. Radvaz instituted many regulations. This is from Yosef Sambari. Amongst them, he abolished the custom of having non-Jewish women, al-raktas, come and sing and dance at weddings and parties. I mean, you have to realize what's interesting is, as we said before, Egypt had a nugget, had a central rabbinic figure who could do anything. And yet he couldn't change this practice, which is not in keeping with halacha, with Jewish law, which gives you a sense of the community there. I mean, it's really, you know, you think says that only modern rabbis have difficulties with congregations. It was only the Radvaz, he came in, and probably there was a new spirit, because you had all, if there's the people who came in from these emigres from Spain, or at least, you know, were people who risked their lives for Yiddishkeit. I mean, this was a creme de la creme Spanish Jewry. They were not interested in compromising anything. So in all probability, not only the Radvaz, but the people who came with him had similar views. And once you had the infusion of these new people, it was possible to make changes. Another thing that he instituted, which is also amazing, was regarding burials. In those days, because of the enmity of our enemies and the severity of the bitter and terrible suffering as a part of the yoke of the exile, the Jews were not able to go en masse and bury their dead. Those are always being attacked. Instead, they would hire a Jewish donkey driver or camel driver who would carry the body on the back of his donkey or hump of his camel a long distance till he would reach the Jewish cemetery and bury him there. In other words, the Jewish cemetery was very far away from the Jewish community there in Cairo. To relieve themselves of their burdensome load, these people would often just throw the body into some pit or valley on the way. Over the course of time, Hashem awakened the spirit of the sages of the city and its leaders through the saintly Radvaz Zal. Zal is short for Zichrono Levrocha, may his memory be for a blessing, at their helm, and they boldly stood up and repaired this great breach. They instituted a new organization consisting of many members who were assigned to bury the dead on a regular basis and to bring them to the graves of their forefathers. These pure individuals served as a sign against those unscrupulous people who belittled the sanctity of the dead. The first group that was assigned this task by the Rav Zal was the Chevra Kedisha of the community of Frankosh. In other words, this is French or Ashkenazic Jews. For they were people of strength and courage. In other words, the Egyptian, there were three communities in Egypt at the time. There were the native Jews, and those who spoke Arabic, and these were been there for generations and generations. They were called the Mistarev. They were the influx of the Sephardic Jews, or Jews who came from North Africa. They were the Maravi, those came from Myra, from the West. And there were the Frankosh, assume, or French or Ashkenazic Jews, who also settled in Egypt. And describing them, they were people of strength and courage. They went up many times to the cemetery and suffered at the hands of the Arabs. They were not affected by all of this adversity, for they firmly committed themselves this mitzvah with a joyous heart. The next group who were involved were the Mistarev, the native Jews of the Arabic countries, for they rightfully had preference. The final group was a community of Western Spanish Jews. This is the organization that the Rav Zal instituted for the purposes of burial, as well as for the rejoicing of the bride and groom at their marriage. In other words, they had people who were assigned to come to chasanas, you know, to come to marriages and to make it merry. You know, not everyone had things, so they really had these volunteers. One wonders if they were fed or not. He continues on, this is from the Divrei Yosef Sambari, and he says in the bottom of page 10, also including the legislation and agreements which he instituted to correct some of the problems which existed here in Egypt, was the compromise reached between the holy community of the Mistarabim, in other words, the Mistarabim is the native Jews, and the holy community of the Western Jews. This quieted and brought to a stop the bitter arguments and conflagrations that erupted between them regarding the custom of prayer and the order of the reading of the Torah. As each one came with their own customs. There was only one synagogue in all of Cairo. There both communities prayed. Each had their own shliach tzibur, shamash, and president. Evidently they took turns. The Mistarev community, however, was the most powerful, and the Maravim, the Western Jews, were subservient to them. The official custom of the Cairo synagogue was the custom of the Mistarabim. As time went on, however, the community of the Maravim, the Western Jews, became bolder and wished to take the leading role. They came before the court with a Radvaz Zal, and a peace accord was made. Regarding another area of dispute, as this really had to, which touched upon this, the Radvaz himself speaks. It may have included the previous issues. The following question was brought before him in the year 5299, that is in 1539. The Sephardic Spanish community was aroused against the community of the Mistarabim, the native Jews, regarding the loud repetition of the prayer, Chazoras Hashatz. The custom is, when you go to a shul in Daven to pray, is when it comes to the period of the Amidah, the Shemoneh Esrei, everyone prays standing silently, and then it's repeated by the Shliach Tzibur, the Chazan. The origin of the custom of the repetition, not the custom, it was actually instituted by law, was because there was, during the period of when the prayers were instituted, they were not written down. Not everyone was familiar with it. They're reluctant to write down prayers and siddur because of neglect, like what would happen to the siddurim. So nothing was written down. It was all baal peh. It was all memorized. Not everyone had that capacity. Not everyone was that educated. So what would happen would be the first people would daven, would pray quietly, those who knew how to pray, including the shliach tzibur who practiced, and those who prayed the first time. After the first time, he would now do it a second time, loudly, for all those who didn't know how to pray. And this is the origin of this practice. And keeping that in mind, now we could just read together. The custom in Egypt was that the reader would only say the prayer once in a loud voice. And that wouldn't be the repetition. He daven twice. He would only daven once. Then when it come to the part where we're supposed to daven Shemoneh Esrei, the chazan would say it out loud, and the community would pray together with him. Those who knew how to daven would say it by themselves, and those who didn't would just listen and answer Amen at every bracha, at every section. Yeah, let me just again. The custom in Egypt was that the reader would only say the prayer once in a loud voice, and the community would pray together with him. This is against the legal opinion of the Talmud, the latter authorities, the Poskim, the Gaonim, as well as the Mekubolim, scholars of Jewish mysticism, which of course they wanted to. The original thing is as we do today. And again, the Chazan, together with the congregation, davens silently, and then there's the loud repetition. This used to be the custom in all of the kingdom, and there was just only one recitation in Jerusalem, Gaza, Safed, Damascus, and Aleppo. The populace there criticized this custom, and it was abolished. So too the community of Egypt should recant and revert to the practice of saying two prayers. In other words, this was the one who petitioned the Radvaz, said, listen, they all changed. You know, this is they should change in Cairo too. One silent and the other in a loud voice by the reader. The community of the Mistarabim claims, on the other hand, that this was instituted by the Rambam Zal. There's the idea of only one, there's not the two, there's not you say it silently and then out loud, but only the out loud, and the others who know how to daven would just daven together with the chazan. And this is a copy of his responsum. It's interesting, the Rambam wrote a tshuva here, wrote a responsum. It is fit in our times that they not first pray in silence afterwards in a loud voice. This is because when the shliach tzibur prays out loud, those who have already prayed tend to turn around to speak to their neighbor, just speak idle talk, and turn their faces from the east and spit. These are spit initials. When his neighbor does not know how to pray and needs to listen intently to the prayer of the reader sees his example, he will follow suit, thinking that no attention need to be paid to the reader. If so, he has not fulfilled his obligation of prayer. And the whole intent of the law of the repetition of the shliach tzibur, the reader, which is to service those who do not know how to pray, has now been rendered void. Because those who prayed the first time would just talk and shul. To avoid the problem, as well as the desecration of his name amongst the non-Jews, who are shocked the Jews converse and spit in the middle of their prayer service, it's far better to have everyone pray in unison in sanctity. Those who know how to pray will pray in silence, and those who do not know will listen. All of them will bow down together with the shliach tzibur, the reader, and will face together the sanctuary in the east with concentration. They will thereby all fulfill their obligation. This is a quote from the Rambam's tshuva. So the native Jew says, you know, the Rambam. You know, so how could we go against the Rambam? Now this is what the Radvaz said. After a long discussion, he says, therefore, in our case, is it possible to convince them without controversy to revert back to the guidelines of the Talmud? To pray two prayers, it is proper to do so. He felt that it should really, whatever reasons the Rambam did it was for that generation, it should not be done permanently. If it is impossible, however, to abolish the present custom without fighting, it is better to remain passive and continue the present custom. Another thing that Divrei Yosef brings is amongst the Radvaz's legislation on page 12 was the abolishment of the Seleucid calendar. In times of the Talmud, in times of the Gaonim, when they would their calendar, and as they wanted a specific year, was based upon the Greek calendar, the Seleucid calendar, it's called, named after the Syrian Greek king, Seleucus. And it started 380 years before the destruction of the temple and was used constantly. In other parts of the world already, they started using what was the Mibrius Olam from creation, which is now the common thing. See, Ksuba, you know, Ketubah is written. So the year is from creation. He was the Radvaz, was abolished the old Seleucid Greek calendar in favor of what we have the common calendar now, which is we date it from creation. Another very interesting thing is Radvaz annulled the practice of making an announcement in the synagogues on the holy day of Shabbos on behalf of a person who fell on hard times and was forced to sell his home. And evidently they spoke about the sale of the home on Shabbos. He ruled it was forbidden to do so on the Sabbath day. And you can imagine the real estate broker comes up and says, you know, there's three bedrooms and a garage and a central heat, you know. The Radvaz was an extremely busy person. Not only did he spend much time devoted to his own learning and his rabbinic responsibilities, he also was a wealthy businessman and also was responsible for the collection of taxes to the government. The following selection gives us a sense of the difficulty he had in juggling all of his responsibilities. And in one shuva he writes, a query was sent to me from Aboukir to Alexandria. I was requested to expound on a certain subject from a person whom I do not know. He continues on, he says, he should be blessed nevertheless, for he has forced me to accustom myself to matters of halacha. Evidently, he was totally involved in his business activities. Even though I am engrossed in matters dealing with the government and making a livelihood, becoming engrossed in fulfilling mitzvahs is far better and precious to me. Now we'll answer the question. The Sefer Kori Adoris, again from David Conforti, writes here on page 13, I heard from reliable sources that the Rav, the Radvaz, found a treasure within his own house consisting of many thousands of dinarim of gold. He distributed them to Torah scholars, one portion to Torah scholars in Egypt, another to scholars in Hebron, another to Jerusalem, another to Safed, which again we see evidently in Hebron at that time there must have been a large Jewish community. In his lifetime, the Radvaz made landmark decisions, some of them still having impact to this day. And again, just want to touch upon this before we go further on. He describes an incident here with an Ethiopian woman, you know, from the community of, from the Ethiopian Jewish community, from the land of Ethiopia, which is called Al-Habash, who was captured along with her two sons. Reuven bought her and asked as a slave and asked her regarding herself. She said she was once married, and these are her children, whom she had with her husband, who was named, and this is the name of my children. Enemies came and killed the men who were at the synagogue at the time and captured the women and children. It became apparent that she was from Jewish descent from the tribe of Dan, who live in the mountains of Ethiopia. I believe from the tribe of Dan is really based on the letter of Eldad Hadoni. So we did in the very first lecture of this whole series. We discussed this goes back over 10 years ago. We discussed the story of Eldad Hadoni, which seems to be very legendary, describing Jews all across the world from the 10 lost tribes, amongst them describing the Jews in Ethiopia and saying that they originally come from the tribe of Dan. And that's probably what he's basing himself on. During this whole period, up until the present, they considered her to be an aguna, a woman who could not remarry, because she admitted she married, and were reluctant to believe her that the husband was actually killed. And there's always a problem that a woman could take liberties when she feels her husband was killed. because it was wartime, to actually say so, even though she may have really not seen actually that he actually died. During the interim, Reuven had relations with her and gave birth to a son who since reached manhood and wishes to marry a Jewish woman being part of the community. Is he allowed to do so, and what should he do? So he discusses the halachic ramifications of believing a woman in such a situation in terms about the death of her husband. But then he goes on in this response and to touch upon the Ethiopian Jewish community. And the problem is that you know, the basis of, are there in order for a woman to be considered divorced, she has to have a proper get, a divorce document. These people were not familiar with all with divorce documents in the rabbinic sense, in the Torah Shebal Peh. So they could get married, and if they have divorces, then divorces are not valid. And if the woman remarries, then the children are not considered to legitimate children. They're mamzerim and cannot marry the normative Jewish community. So this creates another whole problem. The problem is not just for the Ethiopian community; it's a problem for the Karoyim, the Karaites, you know, who also believe only in the written law. And again, a similar problem exists with them. I mean, the truth is, la halacha, we are machmer when it comes to the karoyim, and we base ourselves really to the tshuva of Natronoi Gaon, the Gaonim, who claim about this problem, that the marriage is a valid marriage, but the divorce may not be a valid divorce, and they have a problem what's with the children. So you don't know who comes from whom. So on page 15, we just want to quote to you the tshuva of the Radvaz dealing directly with the Karoyim. You ask me my opinion regarding one of the Karaites who accept upon himself rabbinic Judaism and fill all of the rabbinic laws to refrain from all that the rabbis have forbidden, whether he is allowed to marry a woman from the rabbinic community, whether his marital status is impaired. And he writes, I have been asked about the issue many times before and have concluded that they are allowed to marry as long as they commit themselves to be like us. The reason is that all of their kedushin are done in the presence of witnesses whom the Torah deems to be invalid. Because since the people don't practice, you know, rabbinic Judaism, they really are not valid witnesses. So the marriage was never a marriage. Well, if the marriage was never a marriage, so they don't need a divorce. Relations with one of their wives is not considered adultery in the eyes of the Torah. Therefore, even though their divorce documents, gittin, are invalid, does not affect the status of their children. This is not universally accepted, but and the problem is, I mean, he touches upon it himself in the reason. It may be true that present day that is the case, but originally those who became Karoyim, and they came with their families, you know, they were married. What happens subsequently? They divorced their wives based on Karayat doctrine. It may be after a few generations that the first ones who had the, you know, had valid kedushin have all died out. So we have the thing, well, they're in a community by themselves and all the witnesses are invalid. But what about the first ones? So the Radvaz himself maintains that that we don't have to be fearful of it. It's just so, we don't know even if it ever happened. Who's to say that any of them ever got divorced? And even if they got divorced, who said they ever have any children? But he continues on in this response. And there was an incident that occurred at the end of the 267th cycle. If you go with 19 year cycles, the cycle is 1295 to 1314. It happened at the end, so it's close to the year 1314. Did a large group of the Karayat community return back to the true faith in Egypt under the auspices of the Nugget Rabbeinu Avraham HaChosid Zal? And to this day, these families consist of Kohanim and Yisraelim who are deemed to be a proper lineage, and no one protests the fact. On the contrary, they marry amongst the most prestigious families who practice rabbinical Judaism. This incident was attested to by the author of the Kafter Vaferach in the 1300s. Therefore, if two other halachic authorities of this generation agree with me, I will allow them to marry within the community. The Rav Yaakov Beirav is quoted by his Talmud, the Mabit, Moshe ben Yosef Trani, as to have said that his Rebbe, the Marie Barab, did also allow the Karaites to marry within the community. If they did tshuva, as they become, there had been a community. I don't know if the Radvaz ever got a second opinion. He realized himself this was groundbreaking, and he didn't want to rely upon himself. Agreed with the Radvaz, but he wanted to. So I don't know. The Radvaz was a renowned Kabbalist, yet he had a remarkable respect for the Jewish medieval philosophers, as we see in the following responsum. It's interesting, you know. I mean, we've seen this from previous history as well. In the Jewish community, amongst scholars, very committed Jews, there tends to be different, you know, different people are different, you know, and there are different streams of attitude. Some we could call kanoim, you know, very zealous, and some are very tolerant. You know. We find this, you know, this thing which exists today to have existed years before as well. Regarding, on page 16, what you asked about Reuven, again, the word Reuven is always this John Doe, who said in public before a large gathering and embarrassed Shimon by calling him a heretic and saying that other Jews pray to the God of Abraham and Isaac while he prays to the God of Aristotle, because he was into philosophy. And his tshuva's response was, in addition, I maintain that he did not merely condemn Shimon, but all of the holy Jews who walked on the face of the earth, like Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon, Rabbeinu Hai Gaon, and the scholars that came after them, such as Ibn Gabiro, Yehuda Levi, Rav Rami Ben Ezra, and the Rambam. Even though it is true that I continually deter our present-day students from studying this body of wisdom, this is because the minds are weaker today, the wellsprings of wisdom are now closed. I'm afraid lest someone will be swayed to follow the incorrect views that he studies. In any case, this is no reason to allow one to humiliate someone who studies this branch of wisdom, who lives his life according to the Torah and the mitzvah of purity before God. On the contrary, it is befitting that such a person should be honored, since his actions are for the sake of heaven. All kanoim take note. He was, as you say in the Divrei Yosef, he was a mekubal. He wrote works on Kabbalah. Here I quote, though, which is interesting, on page 17, there was a question that was about our custom now. We take tefillin off on Rosh Chodesh before tefillas Musaf. And the reason, his basis is not in halacha, in other words, from the Talmud or the parallel literature, but actually it's from the Kabbalah, from the Sefer Elkanah, which is a Kabbalistic work from the 13th century. And in this, he says, just to skip a few lines, the author of the Sefer Elkanah gives a reason. You should look there yourself, for it is not proper to write in a responsum which will be copied many times over and disseminated publicly. He didn't feel that Kabbalah itself should be well disseminated. Kabbalah should be studied by those who are ready to study it. I too began to take off my tefillin when I read it in the work. I researched this matter, for I have an important principle that I accept anything written in the Talmud or the later halachic authorities or the authors of the halachas, even if it contradicts a statement written in Kabbalistic works. For myself, if the Kabbalistic statement is a stringency, I follow it. If it's a leniency, I ignore it. Even though the removal of tefillin seems to contradict the Talmud's requirement to wear tefillin all day, this does not presently affect us as we remove our tefillin in any case. And he goes on to give a reason that he feels is beyond the Sefer Elkanah, beyond the Kabbalistic reason, give another reason. But evidently, even though he was a Mekubal, he was very cautious in his approach, which is very interesting. Another thing on the bottom of page 17 is that he starts off, this is a question regarding some self-acclaimed scholar who corrected all of the Sforim, this is the scrolls of the Sefer Torah in his domain, on the basis of the Medrash of Shimon ben Yochai. This is the Zohar, a blessed memory, which states the verse Al Tira Oso. This is when Moshe Rabbeinu was told not to fear Og, you know, the king, is written in the full form with the vav. You know, sometimes you get the cholam, the O sound, with a vav, without a vav. Here it's written with the in our Sifrei Torah it's written without a vav. In the Zohar it seems to be understand is written with a vav. And on that basis they corrected it. He says his basic theme is, you can look at it yourself, is that we only correct Sforim on the basis of the majority of the extant Sforim of the scrolls. We don't correct it based on any Medrash. And evidently he, even though he was a Mekubal himself, there was a certain reservation that he did have. And it's really assumes it's not better than any other Medrash. Towards the end of his life, in the year 1554, the Radvaz left Egypt to settle in Eretz Yisrael. And he writes here on page 18, this is paragraph M, I forsook my yeshiva in Egypt to go up to Jerusalem in order to enjoy the fruits of my labor to fill my hopes. But even here I was not free from untold worry and anguish. The taxes in Jerusalem were unbearable. And that's why he was eventually forced to leave Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, to go to Tzfas, Safed. And his disciple writes, this is Yitzhak Krish, when he saw the corruption of the local populace and the immense tax burden which was placed upon him, he couldn't bear the evil, and he left and went to Safed. It was there that he was asked to join the Heavenly Academy. In other words, he died there. And we have from 19, in the Chidah, I heard from the senior rabbis of the holy city of Jerusalem that Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, they remember for the good appeared unto him. But we could well understand the imprint that he left in Egypt and the whole generation, as a Radvaz. The Radvaz in Egypt was the first amongst countless other great scholars and saints. One of them was Shmuel ibn Sid. His story, told over of Yosef Sambari, written almost 200 years after the event, makes for fascinating reading. Of course, in the sense, it also is legendary in its tone, and one has to accept this. I quote this really, really in the same line that we've quoted before about the story of the Chofetz Chaim. You know, we see this in the previous lecture, that the Chofetz Chaim was asked to be a character witness. It was a case of smuggling that I think there were two yeshiva bachram, two former disciples of his, who were charged with smuggling, which was a capital offense. And the Chofetz Chaim, Yisrael Meir HaKoyen, was asked to come to be a character witness. The prosecuting attorney, you know, asked the defense attorney, he says, you know, what is the character of the character witness? Because how do I know that he is of a reputable character? So the defense attorney told over the following story, that the Chofetz Chaim was pickpocketed in Warsaw. And he, knowing that he would never recover his goods, he ran after the pickpocket and said, says, Ich bin der Meuchel, I forgive you, I forgive you. You know, he didn't want him to suffer his whole life because of the sin. So the judge asked the defense attorney, says, do you really believe that story? And the defense attorney said, you know, Judge, to be honest, Your Honor, I have my doubts. But one thing is certain, such stories they don't tell about you or I. So you take that into consideration when we read this story. It's a fascinating story. For Shmuel ibn Sid. Rav Shmuel ibn Sid, in exile from Spain, was the author of the work Klole Shmuel. He was a disciple of Yitzhak de Leon and the son-in-law of Rav Yitzhak Aboab. He stood by his people in the time of the terrible enemies of the Jews. This is Ahmed Murad. He was an expert in the science of Kabbalah, and he thereby removed the demons from the synagogue of the community of Seville, which is called by his name. And as one of the synagogues in Egypt, in Cairo, was called the Seville Synagogue. And it evidently was been started by members who had lived in Spain and Seville and made their own. This is the story. Originally the building was a house and no one could live there because the demons would harm anyone who came in. As a result, many people died in there. When the Rav came to Egypt, he wanted to live in that house, as he was told it was all locked up for fear of the fury of the demons. He then told them this was exactly the reason he wanted to live there. He slept there that night and took with him a piece of wood which was inscribed with a divine name, which he placed by his head. In the middle of the night, he was seized by fear as he beheld a man coming to him with a sword in his hand. He asked the Rav, "Who made you an authority over us? And how do you have the audacity to live here, to dwell here?" Immediately the Rav got up and showed him the staff which was inscribed with a divine name. He told them, this has given me authority over you and your ilk. He ordered him to bring him all the demons which occupy the house. They stood before him, groups and groups of all different kinds. The Rav then screamed at them and made them flee before him as he ran after them, while he kept hitting them until they all descended the large well, which is called the well of Harat El-Kratz. He commanded them never to arise from the well and in no circumstance to harm any human. From that day on, they made the building into the synagogue, which is called by his name. So they're very interesting people who lived in Egypt at the time. The greatest of the disciples of the Radvaz was Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi. He lived between the years 1520 and 1592. I would like to conclude this lecture with his story. He is well known throughout the yeshivas for his work called the Shita Mekubetzis. He authored tshuvas, there were two volumes of responsa, the commentaries of his, but he put together the extant commentaries of the Rishonim, the early medieval commentaries. Ramban, Rashba, Ritva, Rosh, on the tractates and in the yeshivas is Ksuvas, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra, and they're a source which for years those commentaries were not extant. Today many of them have already come from manuscript and scholars have published them independently. But it used to be that was the only source of all of this. He used all of his, he had a tremendous library. And he felt for the importance of the community that this be made widely available. In addition, he put his notations, as we have just by luck, so to speak, what we have in the published Talmud is a copy of the manuscripts which came to the hands of the publishers in the 1500s. In 1520, when we have our Talmud, basically all the volumes of the Talmud are based from that original, the original Talmud that was published in Italy. There are many mistakes in those manuscripts. And these were widely disseminated. So what he did was, on many of the tractates, he wrote, so what was his, is annotations, like commentaries and corrections. So when you learn Kodeshim, as you learn those tractates would deal with the sacrificial halachas, which were not well learned, because it's more, it's off the beaten track. There wasn't so much that give and take that that would have refined all the manuscripts. So the manuscript that came in the hand of the publisher was full of errors. So he writes the variant readings of different manuscripts and different commentators. So it's invaluable when you study these masechtas. He left us with, in a certain sense, for those who are studying in the yeshivas, much more than the Radvaz. Radvaz was his Rebbe. He left us volumes and over 2,000 responsa, 2,000-3,000 responsa, the Radvaz. But in terms of just studying the tractates, the Shita, the Shita Mekubetzis, the Shita the word Shita is opinion, but it means a collection of rabbinic opinions. Is invaluable. I mean, there are other tractates as well, in Beitza, Nedorim, Nozer, that we have from him that we wouldn't have those sources. He came from a very prestigious rabbinic family, the time doesn't really allow to go through, you have the handouts. He was born in Eretz Yisrael, but he moved to Egypt where he became a disciple of the Radvaz. He described himself that he put tremendous effort in his learning. He says in the bottom of page 20, involved in the study of Gemara took possession of me in my youth. The days of my youth had the merit of being dedicated to labor in the study of Torah. My eyes were denied the pleasures of sleep as I stayed awake night after night plummeting the depths of halacha. Because I was so engrossed in Torah study and I was often late for my meals, I frequently was left with only spoiled food. I gave up my body fat and blood for the Torah. He had, as he said, tremendous respect for his mentor, of David Avi Zimra, as well as another one of the greats of that generation, Yisrael de Kareel, which we'll discuss in the next lecture. And when it was a question of their opinion was on a end of a rabbinic conclave, he said, if they made the opinion, there's nothing for me to say anymore. But his... One very interesting thing is we find in his approach different than those who were involved in the Pilpul we discussed in the previous year, where it was very ingenious approaches, you know, and he relied on the, you know, more basically on the works of the early Rishonim, and he felt that their works are authoritative, and really once they said, says we're not in a position to disagree with them, and really that approach really is has become really the mainstream approach. And again, you could look his on page 22 and 23. But not only was he a tremendous scholar and left us with a wonderful legacy, but he was very much involved in the community. In his eulogy, written by Yisroel ben Moshe of Najara, here on page 23 in paragraph 8 and H, he says, he was a holy man of God who devoted himself to the community and accomplished much good. He passionately fought against injustice and rescued the oppressed and exploited. He was an outstanding leader. And it was really because of him that we started off before about the office of the Nogid, of this leader, that... For all practical purposes, at least the strength of that position was irrevocably changed because of an incident described here on page 24. Here it says in the Divrei Yosef or Yosef Sambari, and it's a fascinating thing, and we'll finish the shir on this note here. At that time, the Sultan Suleiman transferred to Egypt Mahmud Pasha, his vizier, to be governor of that land. This is, it seems to be approximately in the year 1558. In his term of office, the Nogid, the leader of all of Egyptian Jewry, Rabbi Tajir, died. Evidently, we see from here that it had been reinstated. As it came to an end in 1517, the position of Nogid, this leader, evidently for time afterwards, in the time of the Radvaz, it still had not been restored. But subsequently, it seems that they had appointed a leader, this Rabbi Tajir. In his place, the community of Constantinople, which was the seat of the Ottoman Empire, sent Rabbi Yaakov ben Chaim of the family Talmud to be Nogid. When he came to the city, he stood before the potentate. This is this vision, the Mahmud Pasha. And he recognized him, the vizier, to be the Nogid, according to the directives of the government, and clothed him with the raiment of nobility. So it seems he had all of the powers of the previous Nagidim. On Shabbos, after the prayer service, the leaders of the community, led by Rav Betzal Ashkenazi, came to greet him. The Nogid, however, did not act towards them with respect and not treat them properly. Evidently, he felt that he should make... and to show them who's boss. As he was appointed to be the Nogid, and he is the one that they should all feel subservient to. The chief rabbi was incensed, this is Ritzal Ashkenazi, and verbally tore him apart. The Nogid responded with words of humiliation and curses. It reached such a state that the Rav could not hold himself back and excommunicated the Nogid, then left in a fit of anger. As soon as the Nogid saw this, he hastened to the palace of the governor to report to him how Ashkenazi had slighted the honor of the government. Because his claim was, I'm a government-appointed official. They didn't slight me, the person. They slighted the whole government. When the Rav became aware of what was happening, he too arose early Sunday morning to go to the palace of the vizier, governor, a person whom he knew for a long time. He carried with him a Tanakh, a Hebrew Bible. Now, this is an amazing story. You know, sometimes you cannot take the direct approach. And he said as follows. In a private audience, he told him, "My master, the prince, knows from the day the crown of our kingdom fell and we were exiled amongst the nations, you're careful that no Jew has the audacity to call himself king. For only to you does kingship belong," you know, sire. "But behold, this man who has just come to the capital city, Yaakov ben Chaim Talmud, has given himself the title Nogid, which is synonymous with the term king. This is evident from the book of Samuel." This has to do with David HaMelech. "As the Targum translates the verse, Lord has commanded him to be Nogid over his people." Referring, this is Shmuel HaNovi referring to David. "As king over his people." In other words, Nogid is synonymous with king, and he pointed to the verse. "As I said it, I showed him the Tanakh. To this," he added, "I have already rebuked him, and he is now hastening to tell it directly to my master, the vizier." So he hadn't come yet. You know, he has the chutzpah to call him. We never call our people king. "Now I rebuked him, now he's coming, he's complaining. As soon as he heard this, Achman Pacha removed the title Nogid from Yaakov ben Chaim and formally made into law that no Jew may come from the capital city bearing the title Nogid, but rather the title Jibili, which means gentleman. This is how the last honorable position of the Jewish people came to an end. After 580 years, the honorable title of Nogid was removed from us, a holy office which came into being even before the royalty, the Nasi Resh Galusa, had ceased from Babylon." So he felt bad because of Yosef Sambar, because he gave a tremendous pride to the Jewish community. We have a Nogid, which is in a certain sense a semi-king. But in self-defense, this is a brilliant stroke of the Tzal Ashkenazi, but basically what he did was he cut the feet below him, and this fellow had met his match. At the end of his life, Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi moved to Eretz Yisrael, became very involved. He moved to Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim was in terrible state. And he went around, he was already an elderly Rav, and he went around collecting for the poor of Yerushalayim. There was also a problem with the Ramban shul, basically as a Ramban, which there were terrible problems. It was right next to a mosque, and the Arabs were giving terrible problems, and they had shut it down, which was a terrible moral blow for the morale of the Jews of Yerushalayim. So he was involved. Here's a fundraising letter describing the greatness of Tzal Ashkenazi and asking others to help. This is from Damascus. He came to Damascus and it was sent from Damascus. And then finally, this is the eulogy delivered by Yisrael ben Moshe of Najara. We sing on Shabbos on Friday night. The thing after is Kol Ribon Olam. You know, V'Omaya. This is written by Yisrael ben Moshe Najara. He was a Talmud, a disciple of the Arizal. And he writes, "When he heard about the passing of the perfect sage, the crown of scholars, Rabbi Tzal Ashkenazi Zal, who died in Jerusalem, I burst into tears, the teardrops forming pools on the ground below. He left his abode in Egypt to leave over his legacy in Jerusalem and to immensely strengthen the charities there. He restored the fallen glory as he provided food, clothing, and shelter for those who dwell in Jerusalem, the presence of God. The news of his passing spread throughout every city, and there was mourning in every corner. A crushing blow of this magnitude has not occurred to the Jewish people since the passing of Gedaliah ben Achikam." In the next lecture, I'll discuss the life of, again, one of the Rabbonim of Egypt who moved to Eretz Yisrael, eventually to Tzfas, became the leading Rav there. And in his lifetime, he reinstituted the practice of smicha, which is the appointment of judges for the Sanhedrin. He met much and unexpected opposition. It doomed the project. It's a fascinating story. Even the Radvaz was opposed to it. And that story and much more will be the subject of the next lecture. I hope to see you then. Now, are there any questions?
You mentioned the dating of certain events from creation. What is considered creation? First day, sixth day, or what?
You want to know when creation was. First of all, you know, it's a long time ago. It's hard to remember, you know. There are really two creation calendars, which is very confusing. In fact, there's a very lengthy responsum, tshuva from the Maralbach. There's a Levi ibn Chaviv, the son of Rav Yaakov ibn Chaviv. We discussed in the last lecture. We'll speak about him in the next lecture. Actually, there are two ways to count creation. The whole idea of counting creation is based upon the calendar of Rav Yosef ben Chalafta and the Seder Olam. Seder Olam was a brisa written by Rav Yosef ben Chalafta. You know, approximately the year 160 of the Common Era. But it's based on the sources of Tanakh and the, you know, of the Hebrew Bible and the rabbinic tradition. There is what we call the historical calendar and the astronomical calendar. The historical calendar counts the year. Year one is when Adam came into being, which is the sixth day of creation. That's the historical calendar. And that's really the calendar which is used in the Talmud itself. The other is the astronomical calendar, which we find in the work of the Rambam, which counts year one as the first 5 days of creation, the pre-period of before man came to this world, and that's all counted as year one. So it was, you know, there's a famous, the famous word called the longest day. So this was the shortest year. So that abbreviated year was year one. Now if you go to the bookstores, the Bornstein Spitzers, and you pick a calendar and it has a year, that year is the Rambam's calendar counting year one is from just 5 days. So if you have an Iksuba, whatever it is, on a document and it has a year, that year is based on this astronomical, as we count the first five days as year one. Yeah, that's right. It's a very simple thing. The question is just when you just find something, a work, and says a date, you have to know which calendar they're dealing with, which comes out, you know, problems. Yeah.
Another date question, which
year? Oh, right. Oh. You live so close to Dearborn and you ask such a question. AH is Anno Hegira, the beginning of the Muslim calendar. It starts when Muhammad, I think it was the year 622, fled from Mecca to Medina. That was the beginning of their calendar. So this is, according to that, this is this year. What comes a complicating factor with the Anno Hegira is not only just the count of years. The Jews have a lunar calendar, which is adjusted approximately every third year for the solar calendar. So they're approximately always in sync. The Muslims don't have this. So they just have a 12-month lunar calendar. So theirs is a 354-day year, which is missing 11 and a quarter days every year. So after a while, you know, it's like Senator Everett Dirksen said, he was a senator from Connecticut, you know, about the finances in Congress. He says, a billion here, a billion there. After a while, it adds up to real money. You know, so it's 11 days here, 11 days there. After a while, they fall, you know, there's years. So that has to be adjusted as well.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237. or call 1-800-797-7729.